Welcome to the podcast from MinSpec, the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group. We meet monthly to learn more about the craft of writing. We also have a very active message board at meetup.com/MNSPEC. Today's episode is Breaking into the Big Leagues, a chat with rising star Kelly Barnhill. In the past 4 years, MinSpec member Kelly Barnhill has published 12 children's nonfiction books, one acclaimed children's novel, The Mostly True Story of Jack, and short stories in a wide variety of mainstream and speculative fiction markets. And she's done all this while raising school-aged children. We talk with Kelly to see how she accomplished all this, her experiences with the publishing industry, and more.
So my first publication was in, I think it was 2007, in The Rake, I think it was 2006. And that was the first short story I ever sold, was To The Rake, which I miss that magazine, actually. There's also good reporting. I write both fantasy and literary fiction, and I write for both children and adults. I've written for the school and schools and libraries market with Capstone Press, which has been was a great learning experience, actually, especially just sort of like honing how I write for children, because writing for kids is really hard, and it requires intense economy of language, which is difficult to do. My first book came out this last year, in August 2011. My second book, which actually I brought presents, so I brought a couple arcs if anybody's interested in them. This is my second book, Ironhearted Violet, which comes out in October, so I'm kind of excited about it. It will have art. This doesn't have the art inside, so.
By second book, you're referring to second novel, opposed to second book, because you've actually published a bunch of children's novels.
That's true. I have 12... children's nonfiction, and in my nonfiction, it kind of runs the gamut. I wrote a book called Animals with No Eyes about animal adaptations in very deep caves, and another one about animal adaptations in, you know, sort of deep oceans and whatever. That was a really fun job for me because I'm a very curious person, and also I like how kids think, and I like particularly how grade school kids think, and so I like writing for their sensibilities and for their curiosities and whatever, and also I like to make them laugh. I wrote a book called The Wee Book of Pee, for example. You know, it's really interesting. Pee. Who knew? Right? But it makes me extremely popular when I go and talk to grade schools. I work with Compass Arts, so with their Writers and Artists in the Schools program, so I do week-long residencies, fiction residencies in schools. If I go into a third grade and they have a copy of The Wee Book of Pee in their library, all the boys love me. They just think I'm the coolest lady ever. I wrote a book about sweat. I wrote a book about, you know, it's called Sewers and the Rats Who Love Them and whatever. So those were super fun. A lot of times when I start projects, I don't really know which way it's going to go. I don't really know yet if it's for children or adults until, I don't know, people start murdering each other or having sex. and it becomes clear. I enjoy that. I enjoy sort of the open nature of my work and sort of the question marks, right? Everything starts on a question mark. I like that a lot. Both my novels are with Little Brown, which has been very fun. I just turned in my next novel to my agent, and either he'll be able to sell it or he'll never want to speak to me again, one of the two. That one's called Witless Ned and the Speaking Stones. That's also a middle grade novel. But before I did that, I wrote an adult novel that went nowhere, and then I wrote another adult novel that went nowhere. And those are in drawers, and no one will see them. But I learned a lot. I've learned a lot writing those books. It's interesting to sort of watch yourself make mistakes and watch yourself go down paths that really don't lead anywhere, but the journey is useful and all the same, right?
Can you be specific about what you thought you learned?
Oh, sure. So my most recent adult book is called Little Girl Blue, and it's a mystery novel. And in a lot of ways, it's my most autobiographical novel, not that I solve mysteries, but it was based in a school. And before I moved to Minneapolis, I lived in the state of Oregon, and I had a teaching job at a school that was one of those ex-urban communities that got surrounded by a city, right? So it used to be a working-class mill town, and all working-class folks living there. But because of the urban growth boundary, and because you suddenly had a lot of money moving in, suddenly you had very large mansions in there. You had just a lot of money that was pouring into this community, right? So it was changing. But you had another group of people coming in, too. You had a lot of Latino farm workers who were, you know, second, third generation, had enough money to start putting down payments on houses, and so they were moving in too. So the original population got really squeezed. And so as a result, there was a lot of sort of classist tensions. There was a lot of racist tensions. And 2 years before I got there, there was a neo-Nazi youth demonstration in front of the school. And it was ugly. It was really ugly. And so as a result, like, the whole school was tense all the time, right? And there were kids with names on lists, you know? I had to know who was associated with these groups, who had been, you know? And so as a result, like, and there were keywords that I was supposed to be listening for. Zog, for example, was a big one. You know, and all these sort of, like, you know, sort of neo-Nazi sort of code words, right, that I had to be listening for, and I had to report kids, right? And it was really weird, and it was really uncomfortable being there. And I was just trying to get through it. I was pregnant with my first child. My dad had just had a stroke. We were going to be moving back over here. Like, you're just sort of like got your head down and trying to operate. And so writing this book was really a way for me to sort of encounter that experience in a very different way, and to really be able to sort of play around with, you know, some of those sort of political realities and pushing them to their extreme. And I think there's a lot about that book that I think was good. And I went through the whole query process, and I'm so mistake number one that I made. I made a list of agents that I was going to query, and it was like 400. I don't remember what it was. It wasn't really 400, but it was a lot, right? And I just wrote out this query letter and just sort of sent it off to the winds. And of course, made all kinds of rookie mistakes, like, you know, the switch names, or like, that person doesn't work. But I just didn't do enough research, right? So that was mistake number one. Mistake number two was that I sent this thing out, and I got tons of requests, and then no offers of representation. So I knew that I, A, could write a really good query letter, and B, there's something really wrong with this novel, right? And I just kept on doing it, and it was part of that whole, I mean, we've all been there, right? Like, you send something out, and then it's like you're checking your email 900 times a day, and whatever, and that kind of those obsessive behaviors that you get into that don't actually get the next project done, and don't get the new story written, and they don't actually move us forward. We get into these, like, whirlpool type behaviors where we're just sort of treading water, right? And finally, I got this email back from this woman who had read the first three chapters. She liked them well enough. Then she wants to read the whole book, and she reads the whole book. And her name was Ann Hawkins. She's, you know, I mean, she represents a lot of market women's fiction, which I don't really know what that means, but she's kind of a mover and shaker, and, you know, sort of a smart lady. And so she writes back to me, and it was a letter that I treasure, because she says, you know, I read your book, I read it three times, and I really liked it, but I keep on having this phrase go through my head over and over again, and it's write, writer, wrong book. She said the bones of good storytelling are all here, the chops are here, but this isn't the book for you to enter the market in, and this isn't the book for you to start with. You have written the wrong book. Write me the right book and send it to me. I know. And I was saying that to somebody, and she was just like, oh my God, that must have been so hard to hear. But it wasn't, because I had been doing no writing for months at that point, you know, because it was just query, 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 right? And with that letter, she set me free. And with that letter, it was just, oh, I just have written the wrong book. I know I get it. I just have written the wrong book. I just have to write the right book now. And so the next day I started on Most Interesting Story of Jack. And maybe I'll go back to the Little Girl Blue and see if I can sort of revamp it and fix it and whatever. Or maybe I won't. I don't know. But it was one of those sort of... That's the other thing that, of course, you don't know that until somebody sort of stops you and says, write something else. Because you're on the right track, you just need to write something else. So, anyway.
So, how did you get started with Capstone? Because you did Capstone mm-hmm. before you did.
The
Most Interesting Story of Jack.
So with Capstone, I taught with the Minneapolis Public Schools, and you know the like many of us who teach with the Minneapolis Public Schools, you get your yearly pink slip. And you know, at the time I had small children, and it was just so disruptive to, you know, start the school year not knowing where you were going to be teaching. And I just had my son, and I wanted to take a year off anyway, but we also were broke. So I had used a lot of Capstone's books in my classroom, and so I just wrote them, just a cold letter, just, you know, saying, you know, and I had been doing, you know, some little bits of writing, you know, here and there. Sort of, I'd written a ton of curriculum my first year because I had nothing. And so I wrote over 400 pages of curriculum that first year. Just, you know, trying to remake things for my classes, because in my classrooms I was teaching 7th grade and had kids that were reading, kids who were reading it beyond high school level, and then I had kids who were reading at a pre-K level, and they were all in the same class. So they don't really make curriculum for classes like that, so you kind of got to make it up on your own. So I had sent some samples of like some things that I had done, and I had done a lot of sort of rewriting some of the passages that we were doing, so that I could have my high readers, my middle readers, and my low readers all reading the same story, but different versions of it, so that they could be able to talk on a high, be able to use higher
or
for sure, yeah. So I sent that, you know, like my own little sort of like unauthorized versions of things, and then the questions that I would use afterwards to get kids at all different reading levels talking about the same sort of big ideas and using those analytical skills, even if their reading levels weren't quite there yet. So I sent that to them, and then like 6 months later, they called me and said, you know, do you want to do a couple books? And I said, you know, obviously yes. And those first two books that I wrote for them, actually the whole project ended up getting canned because of some other stuff, but I still got paid, so kept us in beer and diapers for a couple of months. That was good. So yeah, but it was good, and again, it was just an incredible learning experience too. So
after your first two books got canned.
Mm-hmm.
How did you proceed from there?
Well, from
there, they offer you another
yeah.
project?
Yeah, they did, and that's typically how Capstone works. I know that Capstone also runs Stone Arch, and I think that Stone Arch may be different the way that they
yeah.
run things. Yeah.
Yeah,
they tend to be a little bit more you know, open to, you know, pitching and whatever. But with Capstone, it's all, everything is sort of developed in house, and then they hire writers. And so typically, when people want to sort of get on their list, you know, you just start out by sending an introductory letter and a writing sample. I think Julia Olson is the person in charge, if I'm not mistaken. It's in a little bit though. But yeah, that's how it works. And it was really great. They don't, I mean, with work for hire, of course, like if something takes off or if they, you know, sell audio rights or whatever, I mean, you never see any of that. You know, like they pay you whatever it is. And which for me was, I mean, we live on a lot. And so it's, it was really a wonderful sort of, you know, income booster for my family.
How much did they pay for work for hire?
Yeah, so for the longer ones, like I did a series called All Things Horrible, which was, you know, I did, you know, a book about monsters and a book about, like, you know, really disgusting medical practices of the past, you know, or sinister. Those I think were $1,400 a book, and each one took me about a month. to do. So so for and you know, a month like during nap time, so is what it was, what it took me. So so yeah, it was and I don't know, like, and those were the longer ones with a little bit more research. But yeah, that's pretty much what it is. And it's, and that was a couple of years ago. I assume that they're, because they're, what I was making from them was sort of like slowly creeping up book by book. So, anyway, that's what it was. So, yeah. But okay. Capstone is good. I mean, it's for teachers, it's wonderful.
We should probably say what Capstone and Stone Arch, specialize in, which is the lower level, school age reader. So they're basically trying to get the kid who is just beyond, just graduated from the easy reading
right.
categories, and is maybe just beyond that, but is not quite ready to tackle a book like this.
Right, right.
And so they have books that they want to be interested in. The Stone Arch, Capstone does a lot of, I think, nonfiction. Stone Arch does the fiction.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get that in high interest level, but with limited vocabulary. And I guess you were talking before people were writing about some of the requirements that you had to be at.
Yeah, it was crazy. The you cannot have a single sentence with more than 22 words. Your average sentence length needed to be 17. The paragraphs, they had to be chunked. There was some limit on that. I can't remember what it is now. But the I had you know, everything had to be scanned into you know, whatever they use,
the
Rito meters, or whatever it is.
is that schools will pick their reading lists based on these leptiles generated by computers. Mm-hmm. And the lower your score means that, you know, it's the easier it will be for most kids to read. So it's a very complicated process. I'm actually really impressed that you can write within this restraint so easily.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a huge editorial process. That's the, you know, I mean, you just have to refine. And again, it really, I mean, it just forced me to be a much more economical writer. It forced me to, it forced me to sort of be more sort of vigorously funny. In a way that maybe my writing wasn't before, because kids see the humor in everything, you know, and so that's, and also it forces you to sort of put yourself in that kind of mindset of kids where everything is weird, right? Everything is super weird, and that's delightful, you know. And that we as adults tend to kind of normalize that, but a lot of this stuff is really weird. And so to kind of, you know, be back in that place of just being kind of awestruck and kind of playing with the world in that way, and that the things that we consider normal now really are very, very weird. So that's good too. That's a good place for a writer to be in, I think. So I did that for a while, and then was, you know, trying to sell short stories, and with less success.
you still sold quite a few.
I did, yeah. And racked up a lot of objections as well.
I think at this point, I'd like to open this up to questions.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
So, you guys have questions? I mean, I've been sort of, yeah.
Prompting,
but...
So, you hear a debate about whether or not a catalog of short stories is necessary or helpful in getting novels accepted or published. And I've heard both directions. It didn't make any difference to me. I never wrote a word and got published as a novelist, and vice versa. Recognizing that, you know, we're all hoping to copy. It's all. Kelly succeeded because she did this, and so I only bought the same laundry detergent she did. So knowing you can't go from the specific to the general, but trying to get capitalized on the general knowledge that you can.
Okay, so here's my thinking. I think that it probably doesn't make a difference as far as publication, whether or not a novel gets published. But what I do think that having short stories out in the world really helps as far as building leadership, right? So for me, because my short stories are in the adult world and my novels are in the kid world, parents who read tend to have kids who read, so that's helpful. One of the wonderful things about, just our speculative fiction community as a larger entity is that, and this just does not exist in the literary world, is that short stories get reviewed. Right? And short stories get talked about online, and short stories get talked about in blogs. People don't talk about the literary short stories they read. I don't understand it. There are a couple places where you'll see, Large Hearted Boy will talk about it, or you'll see it on the Millions or whatever. But just not very many. And not with the same intellectual vigor that you'll see in the speculative fiction community. And so I do think that there is a utility of that, that when your novel is ready to go, that there is a community of people that are familiar with your work and are kind of on your side, right? It's good to have people on your side. That's what I think. So, yeah.
I would say that there are publishing rules, but one, there are always exceptions, and two, the rules may be different from what they were last week.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
Reviews. Did you send your work out for reviews, or did the publisher send them out?
Yeah, so the publisher did most of that. So to the big places and whatever. So it got reviewed in the LA Times, and it got reviewed at, Perkins and,
School Library
and where else? Some other places, Publishers Weekly, and
the publisher is taking care of it.
Yeah, they did that part.
You were the Little Brown, which is a bigger, bigger group. For smaller press, you're on your own.
Yeah, for sure. And then as far as local people, I sent it to. I actually wish that I had. Little Brown, they're very sort of Stepford wivey. They don't like me doing things on my own, which is problematic because they're just not as efficient as I am, right? Particularly with local people, because I know local people. My sister's a journalist, and so I have all kinds of connections in that way. And so, this time around, I'm sending it to the Star Tribune because I know Little Laurie Herzl, and it makes more sense for me to do it. And I sent it to Hazel and Wren and TC Daily Planet and some other sort of local places because I knew that they would review it and it just meant more for them to come to me because either they know me or they know my sister and so again it's sort of you want people on your side
You said that it was one of your mistakes to just send your novel out to the winds.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend instead?
So what I would have done, so what I did do with Jack that I didn't do with Little Girl Blue is that I needed to have a more nimble approach, so that if things weren't working, that I could change things. So one of the problems with sending it to the Four Winds is they say, no, well, you can't re-query them, or a lot of people don't like that, right? And so what I did instead was I set it up in groups of seven. So I had seven people that were my absolute top seven, and then I had the next group of seven and the next group of seven, and I kind of set it all out, and I created this whole spreadsheet that had links, and I just really thought it through, what these people are selling. I had links to all of their different interviews online and whatever, and really got to, because the thing is, one of the problems with the agent search is that, particularly those of us who are coming from a short fiction background, that what we are accustomed to is yes and no, right? It puts the writer in the role of the supplicant, right? So please say yes.
Isn't
please
that
say
our
yes.
natural role?
It is our natural role, but that's not what the writer agent relationship is, right? I mean, you're hiring your agent, right? So like the whole submission process is kind of weird anyway. But B, you actually do want somebody that like whose taste you like, who has a way of operation that we think you'll be in sync with, who is like-minded, and who you just think you're going to get along with, right? Because, you know, you want it to be a relationship you have for a while. And so that is tricky, right? That's what I wanted to do. And so I had groups of seven. Another thing that I did the second time around was that I was really looking at agents who were in agencies that I think did a good job, but who were the newer agents who had been working under agents that I thought were really smart and talented and whatever. And that is who ended up representing me. The woman who represented me at the time of the sale is no longer my agent because she has left agenting because she fell in love with an officer engineer of the British Navy. It was very smooth. And now she's living in, I think, Jordan. Because he's doing some kind of project there, and so now Steve Malk is my agent. Well, so her name was Lindsay Davis, and she was great, but my book was her first major sale, and which was a little bit of a gamble. But she had been working with Steve Malk for a long time, and I knew that they worked together, that they sort of were more partner agents than anything else, and he wasn't taking on new clients at the time, and so I queried her, and she got my query, and at the time there were five requests, or five people had the full, but she got my query, and she called me like that minute. She's like, send me, I just wanted to hear your voice, she says, and she said, send me the whole book, I'm so excited to read this, and so I was like, sure, and she read it. And called me in 5 hours, offering representation. Like, and you know, I mean, I could have gone with somebody with, you know, who had sort of been around the block a few more times, but I wanted to go with the person who loved my work that much, right?
Where did you do your research on agents?
Agent query is helpful. That's a nice place to start. For a little while, I did end up shelling out money for Publishers Weekly. Publishers Weekly. Publishers Lunch. What is that one? I don't remember.
Publishers Weekly.
Yeah, I think that's
and
what it
Publishers
is.
Lunch.
Yeah.
Is the...
Yeah. So they have a nice database on agents, but really, in the end, I mean, that was like $20 a month, and I only did it for like 2 months, but it's not way better information than Agent Query, honestly. I mean, you get more recent stuff, which is helpful, but a lot of times, if you just Google that person, you'll find their client saying, OMG, you know, he just sold my book, or whatever. So, the internet's super useful
so,
in that way.
So you
yeah.
used Agent Query to, and how did you use Agent Query to determine which agents to do it? I mean, did you type in the titles of books you liked? To see who was agenting them?
Both. They have, you know, you can do their advanced searches to, like, you know, really get a sense of, like, you know, who's got the cross-section. Again, because I mean, my work is kind of all over the place and whatever. So, I mean, looking at people who, you know, do sort of quirky literary fiction and do science fiction and do all kinds of other stuff, right? So I did that, but also just the books that I liked and putting those in and looking that way. So, and then also the library is helpful too because you can find the books that you really like, and a lot of times people will thank their agents and their acknowledgments, and that's another place to do it too. So that's how I sort of I started like just amassing information while I was still writing Jack, just you know save it for later, you know, so that when I was ready to go, I would have a lot of stuff.
And would Agent Query also tell you what other agents you're working with? The agent?
Often. And then, of course, you can Google them and then find them. I mean, there's once. I mean, of course, you know, internet searches. you know, sort of lead into more directions, which lead into more. But the nice thing about that is that a lot of, you know, a lot of times you can find interviews with these agents online, which is a great way to find, to sort of get to know their style and whatever. And then also, a lot of them will, you know, if they're on the faculty of, you know, this conference or that conference, you know, their bios there, and many of them have websites these days too, which can be another, or blogs or whatever, which can be a helpful way of knowing people too. So, yeah.
How did you go about plotting Jack? You said you start with character lines.
Not at all.
I start
every day not knowing what's going to happen next.
I know, right?
It's real. I mean, but of course, it's problematic because, like, it's, you get to like page 92 and you realize, holy crap, I got to go back to the beginning because I didn't realize that this was true about this character, or this wasn't true about this character, or whatever. So it's not the most efficient way to write, but it's really the only way I know how. So
you just let the character
it's this act of discovery, yeah.
There's this comparison I like to make between Stephen King, who we all know and love, and Stephen R. Donaldson, writer of Thomas Covenant and other late classics. King takes interesting characters, puts them in an interesting situation, then sits back and reports on what they do in his head.
Right.
Stephen R. Donaldson, who writes entire pentologies, mm-hmm. can't write word one of a story until he knows how it's going to end.
Yeah. And again, like, I think everybody is built to be some kind of a writer, right? And I think that the worst thing that we can do is to try to force ourselves to be another kind of a writer. This is what works for me, right? Anytime I have ever tried to outline, I write a story that has absolutely nothing to do with the outline. So I also can't follow maps, so there we go.
Kat Reedy said that she found the outlining process to be helpful for her, but what she did was she would write the outline, and then two chapters in, throw out the outline, write another outline. And she said that, you know, she'll go through about 8 or 9 mm-hmm. outlines before she finished the book, because the characters always shifted on her, but it did help to have at least a roadmap of where she thought she was going, even if the roadmap changed.
Right.
Well, if you're working writing into characters, do you keep detailed descriptions of their thoughts, their actions, psychology?
So this is what I do. I'm a longhander. And so I, even though they're very twee and whatever, I love the Moleskine notebooks because it's got that pocket in the back. And so I have my notebook, and the other thing I like about it is that it forces you to write small, and so one page on there for me is about a double-spaced typed page. So I have a really good sense as to, you know, how long my stories are. But they have this little pocket in the back, and so I always have note cards. It's not entirely true that I don't outline, because a lot of times it's like the golden apples that you're throwing ahead, you know, like I'll have an idea of some event that's going to happen next, or something that will be revealed, or something that is true, and so I'll keep note cards that'll just be one or two sentences, and I'll stick those back in the pocket, and some of them end up being completely irrelevant or whatever. But then also I'll just carry note cards in my purse or whatever, and write those in as well, and then stick that in. And then when I run out of room in the pocket, then I have to keep them in a box. But that tends to be helpful because then later on I'll sort of color code them as far as, you know, is this chapter, or are these just characters files or whatever. That's typically what I do. But, you know, I work in my head for a long time. Like, I'll work with the language of the story for a long time before I even start writing it down. It isn't so much that I know the story, but I will know a moment that happens in the story really, really well. And I'll know how that moment is told and how it will sound, right? It's kind of an odd way of working, but yeah.
I would suggest that there is one use for reading, and after reading what authors say about their methods, is that it does give you an idea of all the of how varied people's minds are. I mean, there'll be some writers who think in ways that you could never have imagined.
For real. No, I think it's true.
Pass one of those books around. So
No, these are for
should we actually do like a drawing?
Sure, we could.
I've got a bike helmet. Somebody has like a hat or a better hat, but we could put like slips and stuff into the bike helmet and then do a drawing.
That's a great idea. You guys want to put your little your names on a piece of paper?
If anybody has spare paper that they can donate to this cause, that would be awesome.
I have a question. You were talking about how you know one part of a story really well, and I find that when I'm writing, I know that one part, and I don't know how to get past it. How do you get past the one part you know to expand the story more?
That's a good question. So, I don't really know. So for me, a lot of times I'll start a story while I'm running, and again because I'm a very aural thinker, I was a delayed reader as a kid. I didn't really start reading at all until about fifth grade, but I love being read too. My dad would read S. Dickens and Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and whatever, and all in Grimm's fairy tales, but then I also would listen to books on records, which I would get at garage sales, and so when I'm running,
have a desk slip so we can going around. Don't tear anymore. Don't tear anymore. I see a desk slip of paper going around. And I'm about to turn them into an airplane. No.
I think they'll make it around here.
Okay.
Here we go.
So we've got no slips? Okay.
One more.
Here.
Yeah.
Hang on. Put that right in the middle.
It's because the library closes at 8 o'clock at night, and it is still dark when I leave the library. And I wrote all winter, and sometimes it was dark when I left to go to the library on the days that we weren't open until 8 o'clock. So it was this helps me see the path, because although I've got the Minnehaha Parkway's path memorized, you never know when the wind has blown a big branch in front of you, and you just can't see in sections of that. Alright, so.
And they're all different sized pieces of paper.
Some falling off with the vent.
Alright, ready guys? Okay, so we have two copies of Violet, and I also have a copy of Jack. So, we all three. So, copy of Violet goes to Christian King! Yeah, you're holding it.
You get Violet.
All right. So, and the next one, next hobby of Violet goes to Kim B.
Yay!
So
that was going to be mine.
All right. So you have to wait until it comes over to you, and then the copy of Jack goes to Carol. What? How do you pronounce your last name?
Caputo.
Carol? Caputo. All right. You get
Jack.
Thank you.
Yay!
We share our library.
So those books are available now? Or?
So Jack is available now, Violet not until October.
Right, and it is also available in Hennepin County Library System. Mm-hmm. And yep, you got a very nice review during the Leaders Advisory thing that the Youth Services Department
does. They did!
Every year they have people stand up and review books to each other so they can recommend books. And somebody talked about how this was a local author they'd never heard of before, but wow, was it really great? And so it was a really fun.
Oh, that's really cool.
Would this be a good book to read to my 9-year-old?
For sure. Particularly that Ironhearted Violet. It's kind of short chapters, so it's it'll do well for evening reading, I think.
Cool.
So, do you have a girl or a boy?
A girl.
Okay, excellent. Very good. Very good. Oh. Very excited about that. There's a hidden library and a possibly evil book and a princess who's not pretty at all.
I'm feeling sad that I didn't put my name in. Oh.
Dang!
No, I know I'll do it.
You will, yes, eventually.
Yeah.
So okay. And when it comes out, it'll have really pretty art too. So inside,
yes,
so
it has
well on the front, yeah. But it'll have, I think it's going to have 25 illustrations.
Oh, how nice!
Are these in ebook form?
It will be an ebook, and I don't know if the ebook will have the art. I don't know how they do that actually.
It would be also interesting to see if it comes available to libraries, because Brown's one of the big six.
No,
the big six has been such putzes about selling ebooks to libraries. Here they have a whole huge. I mean, we're 70% of the children's print market.
Yeah.
You would think that you'd want to sell books to that 70% of your market, and we're willing buyers.
But is it a ping?
Oh yes,
million.
Yes, we pay. Mm-hmm. The thing is that you know, if children's books are 70% of your sales, I mean, I think they're offending the libraries by saying we are selling these as e-books, but we're not going to sell them to you.
Yeah, no, it's really
bizarre. I mean, they're offending their major customer.
Yeah,
it's just been ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it's mind-boggling to me. I mean, so we finally made the e-book plunge in my house. My daughter, my 12-year-old, she reads a book a day, right? And so, first of all, the whole like pre-reading your children's books, yeah, that went away a long time ago. If there's anything that is weird or makes you uncomfortable, talk to me about it, and you can stop. You know, I came downstairs and I was like, oh, you're reading Vida Morehouse's Tate Holloway's Tall, Dark, and Dead. Have you gotten to the sex scene yet? She's like, yeah, I just skipped that. I was like, okay.
My daughter discovered Tate Holloway's Tale. And I went, fine, okay, I'm stepping back.
If you have any questions, come to me. And anyway, we were just going to the library constantly, and so she got the Nook so that she could be reading library books, because she'll still have the waiting list and whatever, but you know, as long as she's in Wi-Fi, it just comes right in and it's awesome. But she's noticing that there's less and less available, and I was like, yeah, it's because publishers are.
So, Kelly, you said you did sort of waves of queries mm-hmm. to get an agent the first mm-hmm. time through. And so you were adapting your queries wave by wave, or
yeah, I did. So with Jack, one of the things that I was trying to do with the query was create kind of a language environment that wasn't necessarily explaining the book, but just giving the agent the experience of reading the book, right? And so what that meant is that it had to be somewhat dark. It had to be, you know, sort of pulling the person into the story right away, even if they don't know what the story is. And also having just sort of that sense of humor as well. And that was a little bit tricky. I had to, you know, sort of adjust that going forward because...
So it's a synopsis you're describing?
I have never written a synopsis. In my life, I've never had to
you
do it.
You didn't ask for it, and you didn't send it.
No, but nobody's asked for it. They just said that I would just send them the query and first three chapters,
right.
And they were just like, or the first 5 pages, and then they would say, send me the first 50, and then they would say, I've never been asked for one. Yeah.
I want to see your query letter. Could you post it up on
the website?
You can post it up as members only, so only you know, we see it if you're worried about it. But I would love to see your query letter.
Yeah. So my first,
and also the letter you wrote to Capstone.
Sure, absolutely. The first sentence in my query letter was: "There's a boy who's named Jack who thinks he's a boy. He's not. Don't tell him." At first it started out being funnier in the first few versions. I had to change that because people were expecting a much funnier book. I mean, there is humor in Jack, but it's a pretty dark story, and so I needed to sort of massage that a little bit, but I wanted to sort of put the agent in a place of being unexpected, you know, of unexpected things happening. And so when I was getting this sounds interesting, but it's not really up my alley or whatever, I just started, like, you know, sort of honing it. So I think it was, like, the third wave or the fourth wave that I started, like, getting requests and offers.
That sounds extremely interesting. Would it be possible, if you're going to, instead of just uploading just the last one, if you would be able to upload the different versions?
I'll look through. I'll have to sort of. The thing is, I'm not really good at saving things, so I'll bet you I can find it somewhere in my earlier emails. I'll see if I can find it. Yeah.
Thank you. Because that sounds fascinating. Yeah. How you tweak it depending on what.
No, I'll see what I can do. I'll see if I can find the little girl ruined. Anyway,
a couple steps back when we were talking about the whole problem with selling ebooks to libraries. So the publishing industry is going through all these changes in tumult right now. What do you think is going to happen with it?
I have no idea. I sometimes feel like publishing only exists to make writers feel bad about themselves. Because you sell your book and you still feel bad about yourself all the time, you know? It's a weird business, and it tends to be a very insular business, right? So you're working with people who, they work really hard, and they really only know each other, you know. And they get this kind of groupthink going on, right? Little Brown is great in a lot of ways. In some ways, they have been in the last few years going through kind of what Bloomsbury went through post Harry Potter, where when a publisher gets a runaway hit, you'd think, since they're, like, swimming in swimming pools full of money, that they would be, like, really magnanimous and kind of pro-writer. But the opposite ends up happening. They get very tight-fisted. They get very, just everything's very tight and very sort of hostile towards writers. So, for example, when I got my contract with Little Brown, it took 9 months to get the contract signed. Like, it was just fights between them and my agent about little things. It ended up being a 3-month fight over 3 words. Guarantees versus best efforts. Which my dad, the lawyer, was like, yeah, that's actually really a huge distinction. I was like, shut up! I want to get paid! I have a mortgage, for God's sakes, and my husband's in the building trades, and by the way, the economy's in the toilet.
That's fascinating. What is the distinction between those two?
So, what I sold was North American rights, and I retained all foreign rights, but what that means is that the issue is rights to England and Australia. They did not want the book to come out in England and Australia first. Part of that is because it would make it ineligible for things like the Newbery and whatever, which of course it didn't win anyway, so it was moot point. But anyway, so that's kind of the main issue. But the thing is that they were already planning on delaying the book and weren't telling me that. You know, so that was why this was all happening.
So you bought time is what they were really doing.
So whatever. I mean, it is what it is. I mean,
it's release schedule. That's what they were doing.
Because originally when they bought it, they said it'll be fall of 2010. And then it got delayed by 6 months, and then another 6 months. So, that part of publishing is hard for me, because I am a cards on the table kind of a girl. Like, I suck at cards. I can't, like, that whole, I would be a terrible lawyer. Like, that whole kind of gamesmanship of, you know, sort of holding things, I don't know how to do that, you know. I just have to be fully sort of, like, above board with everybody all the time. And it's hard because when you're operating like that, and not everybody around you is, it causes some just
a lot of predators in the
And it isn't so much even predators, it's just that people just get accustomed to dealing with like that, you know, and like just trying to, you know, sort of just trying to strategize, you know, how we're doing things. And of course it's not just publishing, you know, I mean, my sister-in-law, who's a philosopher and is, you know, trying to, you know, is applying for jobs and whatever. I mean, it's the same there too, right? You know, nobody actually wants to say, you know, who's getting what and what I'm willing to sort of like put on the table, right? I don't know how to do that.
you mentioned, you're talking about that, which is interesting to hear, but also but what got me asking the question was guaranteed versus...
Oh, yeah. So what they wanted was to me to say guarantee. I guarantee that it won't come out in England before it comes out
in the
United States. But, of course, we can't say that because we don't know what's going to happen on Little Brown, and we wouldn't know what's... You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
They decide
it doesn't matter what I say, right? So I actually cannot guarantee anything. Because I am like, as writer, you're like, you're not even on the totem pole. You're like some ant on the ground crawling away.
You would think that by now they would have some sort of template for, you know, newbie authors.
No.
Don't think it sucks. That's why you get into doing this. I mean, some of the ebook rights I've heard, like, for example, is they're going to ask for 10 years or forever, and you're going to counter offer with 5 to 7 or something like that. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, I really did not pay attention to a lot of that thing. My agent is great, and of course, you know, my original agent, she was great, and was working with the guy who's now my agent. Sometimes they can get real hostile with you and just not very nice and whatever. And my agent's real bitchy, so he's great. and he is able to be tough when I can't, because I've got two jobs. I'm a writer and I'm a mom, and sometimes I teach too. But both of those jobs I don't do effectively or well when I am in a place of anger or stress or worry. Particularly parenting. Holy smokes! Yeah. So
in the old days when you actually sold directly to publishers,
right.
Agents were you're basically the person who kept your relationship with your publisher good, because the publisher could hate your agent and not you for being snotty.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the publisher would say, my children don't have shoes, and Steph and your agent would go, bullshit. The agent was the buffer, and the agent was the one who could be hard-nosed for you, so that you could have a pleasant relationship with your publisher. Nowadays, they're the entree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because so many publishers aren't looking at unedited manuscripts.
Right.
It's very weird.
Right.
That's shifted in the last few years.
And of course, the second part is still very true. The book gets sold, and then there's, you know, the ongoing other stuff that happens, and there's a lot of conversations that I just don't have to have, you know, and that's the thing. Like, I mean, you know, it's everybody's always great friends, you know, whatever, that remains weird to me. Like, it's a weird business to be in. I just try to ignore it and write another book. Yes.
So during the negotiations, your agent was involved in explaining the contract to you then?
Yeah, exactly.
And when you were saying we, you meant you and your agent.
Right,
so
for
your
sure.
fellow agent was on your side?
Oh, 100%. 100%, yeah. I mean, I feel very well taken care of. Writer's House is a great agency, first of all. And they also have big fat lawyers. So that's good too. For sure. I, the, I, And Steve is, you know, the. I mean, when Lindsay went off to get married and blah 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 blah, and I was you know, placed with Steve, which of course is a little bit of a weird thing. What Writers House decided to do was, like, all of her clients who had contracts, we were placed with senior agents, and then everybody else who didn't have a contract yet, they were dealt with on a, you know, on a case by case basis, right? And I actually just when I was in D.C. visiting family and got to have coffee with two other Lindsay refugees, right? And we wanted to start a band. We'd call ourselves the Lindsay Situation. So we went and had coffee, which was great because my in-laws are crazy. And you know, you do kind of feel like the redheaded stepchild, you know? I mean, that just is what's going to happen. But despite that, I've been very well taken care of. I mean, first of all, Steve loves my work, which is really great. And I mean, that in itself is huge, you know. What you want in an agent is not an impressive sales record. What you want in an agent is somebody who just really, really believes in your work. And that's the main thing.
So what other ways is the agent taking care of you?
Well, so yeah, I mean, he is, first of all, he's very much a an editorial agent. So I send him work and we work on it together, right?
So it's collaborative.
Yeah, for sure. He also is, you know, he is very focused on cover art. And so and Little Brown, because they have, and not just Little Brown, but a lot of places, because they have worked with him, and they know that he is very much a visual guy and very much a sort of, he comes from an art background. Like, if it's not an awesome cover, he will really, really make them regret it. No, this has to be redone, and it has to be redone today, right? That's he's that guy, right? And so as a result, they try to head him off of the past by giving all of his clients really awesome covers, which is awesome. The paperback for Jack is actually going to have.
I mean, that cover is very inviting.
It's extreme, although yeah. That cover is going to go away. So that's the arc, of course. And the, so the paperback comes out in September, and it's totally different. And it's cool, too.
Just as cool as the hard cover was.
Yeah. So it's this artist, Jacopo Bruno. And it's, you see the silhouettes of the kids, and you see the house, and it's the. He gets I don't even describe it. You just have to look for it. It's really cool. I'm very excited, and I was expecting to hate it because I loved the original cover so much, but that had to go away because of Barnes & Noble. Since Borders went away, now Barnes & Noble is the biggest buyer or the biggest seller of children's books, and the buyer has never liked that cover. Because he felt that it looks like blood veins, because he's so he never liked it. And so when Borders went away, yeah. He said, guess what? That's got to change. I had a really bad attitude about it, but Jacopo Bruno, who did this, he really did a gorgeous job, and, like, it's all hand-lettered with, like, you know, the Jack has, like, roots coming into the name of the letters, and it looks really cool. So I'm excited about it. You see the three kids on the silhouettes on their bikes, and I'm excited, actually.
How important was it when you got your first agent to have a backlog of nonfiction work and, say, short stories?
Not at all, actually, because the nonfiction work was fairly sort of library and school specific. Like, it helps with sort of booking sort of school visits. That is helpful. But as far as, you know, sales or any or like what he could sell the book for, anything like that, it didn't really make a difference.
So it was as though this was your first novel.
Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So mostly it was I think he just saw that as like greater training camp, you know, which is kind of what it was, you know.
Well, that's good for him to know that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's true. It is true. Just for him knowing that I had, you know, other books in the works, that was important too. So anyway, and of course that really didn't become important until after the book had been read, right? But you know, once the book is read and once you've got an agent interested, like that's when you have the conversation about, you know, other stuff you're working on. Whatever. So.
When you send that one novel to the wind, you said you got a ton of requests.
Mm-hmm.
How much is a ton?
I'd say I got probably 40 requests to read that, and no offers. So I mean, clearly it was the query was good, the book less so. So and mostly it was, you know, mostly it was you know, just non-engaged projections, right? You know, just the form and whatever. Until that one from Ann Hawkins. Yeah.
I was just going to ask how long you wait before you decide that, hey, no answer means no.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't even know. I think the rule of thumb is if you haven't heard in 6 weeks, assume that it's either no or they lost it. Which is really the same as no, right? You know? So, yeah. I would say that.
Along those same lines, how about like editors? You mm-hmm. know, we're a little is there any different situation there? If, especially if they've gotten like an open call from a conference or something, and you send it to them, they're like, send it, and then you never hear anything. So
that's a good question. Like, I mean, I've only had one experience with that, and I had met the executive editor at Berkeley Books at a conference, and. I pitched Little Girl Blue to him, and you know, and so he requested it. Actually, I got great feedback from him, and it did take a while. He passed on it, of course, but and I think maybe it was 3 months that. So anyway, but that is my only experience. I don't know if that's typical or not typical. I just have no idea. So
yeah. And some editors, especially in the short story world, will take forever.
Yeah,
I mean, it really is.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
And actually, Form.com.
Yeah.
Oh. They take, what, 2 years to read a short story?
I think so. That's about what it was when I got my rejection.
They pay extremely well. Mm-hmm. They pay extremely well, but it's you have to have complete faith that you've got a quality piece to tie it up for that one.
Yeah, no, it's... they pay extremely well, but you know what? Hearts World pays pretty well too, and they get back to you in a day. You know what I mean?
But like, I don't think it's 25 cents a word across books.
Oh no, I know. But
it's always the highest paying short story market.
Yeah, it's the highest short story market out there. And so you know, you get a small fortune when you sell to them, and it's a nice big exposure. But boy, I was looking at that time frame that they've mm-hmm. got, and I was like, you're not at the top of my list for submitting because.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's too long. I mean, that's just too long. I feel like it's. I don't know. I feel like that's unconscionable, really. 2 years is crazy. I mean, I had given up on a story that I had sent over there. I just assumed that they had lost it or whatever. And I think it was just over 2 years, too. I think it was 2 years and a month. They were like, oh, sorry, it was so long. We're passing. And I was like, I already knew you were passing. I have been operating under that assumption. That's why I've sent it out again. So, anyway. That's all right. Postscripts is going to publish it now, so that's okay. We're all good. Anyway.
A lot of places say that authors need a platform before the publisher will take them seriously. So they're looking for, you know, whether or not Arthur has a blog or a website. Do you have either one of those?
I don't know if that's entirely true. I mean, I think that it's something that is helpful and that they will make use of, right? But in the end, what publishers want is really, really great books, right? You know, so, I mean, it's what publishers want is for us to be great at what we do. And so like that's our main thing, you know, is that sort of going back to your desk and it's the pursuit of excellence, right? And so we can Twitter and we can do blogs and whatever, and those are helpful for sure. I can see that just on my Amazon ranking, right? That like if I am, you know, participating in like, you know, kidlit chat on Twitter or any, or they've, the Thursday one is middle grade lit chat, right? Do you guys ever do the chats on Twitter? They're extremely useful. I like them a lot. On Tuesdays, it's, you know, it's the hashtag kidlit chat. and I think it starts at 8. And it's kind of nice because there's a lot of agents that participate, and a couple editors that participate as well. A bunch of writers at various levels of publication all participate as well. And discussing some.
Can we turn you back to social media?
Sure.
Because I think we're going to be doing a talk on social media. There's a bunch of stuff that I've been struggling as to what getting people for, but yeah. I think. I've never seen a reason to join Twitter.
The chats are actually very useful. And also, I mean, I just have, as far as like, again, getting people on your side and sort of forging relationships with people and whatever. I've met a lot of people through that who are very like-minded and who are writing wonderful books that I would not have known otherwise. On Thursdays, it's middle grade specific. It's MG Lit Chat with the hashtag. And I do think that people get a lot of information. I get a lot of good information. And for me, I notice that, like, if I'm particularly on, like, being my clever self or whatever, I can see that there is within 24 hours an effect on my Amazon ranking. So I do think that it does, like, once you have a book in the world, I think it does help sell books, for sure. And it isn't so much, I mean, the people who are sort of out there sort of like, pimping their books constantly, I don't think that does, that helps. But I think, building relationships and being smart and that pursuit of excellence. And
I also think that it's not super necessary, but if you have an interesting blog, if you have an interesting blog, I mean, Jim Hines has a very interesting blog that's very entertaining to read, and and I've known him for a very long time. He's just very kind, but he's got a wonderfully entertaining blog, and I know that his publisher did push him to go into the Google thing and other areas and forced him to get a Twitter account, but it was because he was so entertaining that he felt that it really did help him.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think with other people, if you're not entertaining in your blog, they don't care.
Right, right.
They really don't.
Right.
And I have, I think, zero readers for my blog.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mostly get people who are Googling tech.
You have Googled.
Along those lines, especially since you kind of have your feet in different worlds, and related to this as far as a platform, for kids in particular, I have that same dilemma. Like, I write my short stories are for adults, and I've got this middle grade novel, and I'm working on those type of stories. And so, to me, it seems like kids aren't on Twitter.
Right.
This seems ridiculous to even be having this conversation. But if you can children's literature perspective,
from a children's
platforms.
Literature perspective, this is why you do it, right? And because the kids are not on Twitter, but librarians are on Twitter.
Okay.
There are a lot of librarians on Twitter. There's a lot of teachers on Twitter. There are a lot of parents on Twitter. There's a lot of mom bloggers on Twitter, right? And it isn't so much. I mean, it isn't so much about self-promotion. It's about building relationships, right? And you can find the people who are saying interesting things, and you can engage in conversation with the people who are saying interesting things. And that, I do way more promotion of my friends' books than I ever do of my own, right? Because I feel that, because I feel like it's important. I've got I have a lot of followers now, and I want them to be reading these other people's books because I think that they're important and wonderful and whatever. But again, it's being part of the conversation is really important, I do think. And I don't think it's vital, I don't think it's necessary, but I think that it's useful. And it is a thing that you can make. And how else am I going to waste a lot of time? Cleaning my house? No, thank you. So, anyway, yeah. So, again, I mean, I think the whole idea of platform is way more important for people who are nonfiction writers. I mean, absolutely, if you don't have a platform, you're done, right? And it's hard to, like, identify that. I mean, I know that a good friend of mine was pitching a nonfiction book, and he's got... I'm filled with jealousy every time I look at his publication record. I mean, he's been published in Esquire, he's been published in Harper's, he's been published in World Hum, he's been published in Best American Essays, he's been published in all this different stuff, right? And but they felt that he didn't have enough of a platform. Really, and because it was nonfiction, and because that's just as the world, right? So, and maybe in a few years that'll be different, but that's what it was now, and that was, I mean, I was enraged, right? I was filled with righteous anger, but for us, it's less necessary. Again, what we need is relationships, so. Social media. Such time suck. It's ridiculous.
See, that was what I was going to call it. Like, how to use social media without using you.
Yeah. And it is problematic. You know, when Jack came out and the reviews started coming out, and you know, there was various, like, you know, people talking about it on social media and whatever. It was, I mean, my reviews were good, you know, and many of them were very good. I got 4-star reviews and, you know, whatever, and which is great. But at the same time, I thought that I would be ready for that because I had been published in speculative fiction magazines and I had been reviewed before. But I found it extremely silencing, and I kind of, like, all of my work kind of ground to a halt for, you know, 4 or 5 months. And so social media can be a trap because you just are, you know, looking and looking. You know, are people talking about my book? Are people talking about my book? Has my book vanished? And that I was visible in a way that I had never been visible before, and that was terrifying. And I was all simultaneously terrified of becoming invisible, and which is interesting because so is Jack in my book. So I was sort of like living vicariously through him, and it really was very difficult. Finally, a friend of mine sort of sat me down and he's just like, "Listen, everybody who publishes their book for the year after, you're a total lunatic and a basket case, and it happens to everybody, and it's okay." And I was like, "Oh, God." And social media can be problematic in that way as well. Another friend of mine who she's been in AA for many, many, many years, and I adore her, and she's one of those sort of AA angels. She's got, you know, a gazillion sponsees. And but she said, "You know what And my sponsor told me, you know, because she's in journalism and, you know, was fussing about sort of similar things. She says, you know, what other people think about you and what other people think about your work is actually none of your business. And all your only business is just being better every day, right?" And I was just like, "You're right. It is none of my business." And that was kind of a freeing thing. So anyway, social media it can be extremely useful. But you kind of go into it with your eyes open. So, anyway.
Another time set can be the forums.
Yeah.
Writers forums. I was in Science Fiction Fantasy Online Writers Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how long do these people find time to write?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're posting constantly.
Yeah. You know? Or they're not sleeping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm. Codex.
Oh yeah, Codex too. Yeah, no, I was on Codex for a while, and eventually, I just, like, at some point, you just have to decide, like, what you're going to follow and what you're not. Those things are useful because it makes us feel less alone, you know, and it's nice to have colleagues because we usually don't. We have no water cooler, you know, and sometimes you do need that, you know. It's sort of like the virtual, you know, version of the, you know, cigarette break, right? But yeah, you do have to, you know, be very sort of like, because otherwise it can just be too much. And then
I did learn a lot there. I mean, I learned a lot about query letters and,
yep,
and formatting your a manuscript and all of that. But on the other hand, you know, when you have a month-long flame war over what a white horse really is genetically.
I love where we live in. That's
better.
just to call a pair of matched grays.
If I'm writing a story and somebody says, you know, where'd the guy on the white horse go? I'm not going to say, do you really know the genetics on that?
Yeah, right.
I'm going to say it that way.
Yeah, exactly. That is hysterical.
They got no response.
Yeah, that is hysterical. So again, you know, it is easy to waste time though. So.
Well, it's about 1:30, so we probably should start closing up shop so that the 2:00 workshop can go, and people who are in the 2:00 workshop have a few minutes to stretch their legs, get something to eat, or whatever it is that they need to do. We usually give them a little bit of a break. So, is there any last parting words you want to share, or last minute burning question that anybody wants to ask?
Any burning questions?
Okay, no burning questions.
Oh, okay. What about your work schedule?
Oh, so for when the kids are little, I wrote from 4 to 6 in the morning. And then I would write a little bit in the evening. And then,
I did that for a while.
Yeah, and then a little bit during nap time. The work I did in that time was uniformly terrible. Eventually, I got a grant for some child care. In which I...
What was the name of that grant?
Jerome Foundation. The Jerome Foundation Emerging Writers Grant, which at the time was administered by Sassy the Right Place, and then Intermediate Arts. And I believe The Loft administers it now. In fact, there may be a deadline coming up, FYI. But you can write it for child care. So I was able to get daytime hours for the first time, and then I worked on the book that I did not write the grant for at all. But I wrote most of the short story of Jack, so that was good. So that was when I started having daytime hours. That was really great. Now what happens is that my oldest goes to school at 6:30 in the morning. My two younger kids go to school. I drive them to school at 8:45. I'm home at 9. I work for 3 hours. And then I go for a run to clear my head. And then I come back, and it's depending on the day. It's either editing or it's paying bills and doing sort of housewifey stuff, or it's getting my house clean, or it's taking care of all of my emails. I try to limit what days I check email. And when I'm working, when I'm really seriously working, I send my internet router in the car with my husband when he goes to work, and I unplug all the phones, and it drives my mother crazy, but oh well.
I have to shut off all the lights too.
Or I go to a coffee shop and work there just to like, just I'm totally unavailable and I turn on the Mac free.
Do you have like a word or a page goal that you do when you're proposing, right?
I don't. I just
for more hours than,
right. Lately I'm working on a book called The Boy Who Loved Birds. That one I actually have a page limit. I'm working longhand, and I can't write any more than 3 pages a day because I want this story to happen very slowly and to be very deliberate with it. So that one, I'm sort of letting it spin in my head, and it's 3 longhand pages, and I'm not allowed to go past that. I want this book to be lean and spare. And I don't want it to be any longer than 40,000 words. And so I just am intending to keep it very, very intentional. So,
what's the genre?
This one, I wanted to write a book in which the speculative element was a question mark from beginning to end.
So magical realism?
Yeah, sort of. It's a story about a girl who whose father has been sent to Afghanistan. She has a single dad. She's been sent to live with her estranged grandmother, who has a foster home. And so it becomes a story about forgiveness and about how
Yeah, it's a story about forgiveness, and it's also a story about war, and it's a story about a this redefinition of family, and about a boy who may or may not be able to talk to birds. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much, you guys.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group podcast. The MinSpec podcast is produced by Aberstaff and Wiebe, recorded and engineered by myself, Conrad Zero. Whether you're an experienced writer who wants to help others, or an aspiring writer who wants to make their writing better, join us on the web at meetup.com/MNSPEC.